I never, 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 ever opposed voluntary busing. And it was a program that Senator Harris participated in, and it made a difference in her life. I did support federal action to address root causes of segregation in our schools and our communities, including taking on the banks and redlining and trying to change the way in which neighborhoods were segregated.
All right, we should note that he said he never opposed voluntary busing last night. He said he never opposed busing, period. What's your reaction?
Well, first of all, the record speaks differently in some of his quotes from the time. I find reading them, and again, it's decades ago, problematic. He needs to talk to his record, as we all do.
Who says the 70s are dead? Busing politics are back, baby. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I am Matt Welch, and you were just listening to New Jersey Senator and 7th place Democratic presidential contender Cory Booker reacting on CNN over the weekend to post-debate clarifications of sorts by Joe Biden of his record on desegregation via school designations and transport, which was the source of the most electrifying exchange during the grown-ups night of the two-part Democratic presidential debate last week. California Senator and former busing pioneer Kamala Harris having plunged the "I don't think you're racist, but" knife into the front runner's ribs. Let's bring in our all-star cast of commentators, Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy July, comrades.
Hey, Matt.
Yay, July.
Happy fireworks week.
If I am not mistaken, and y'all will correct me, I think most of us, maybe even all of us on this podcast, have had some personal experience either being bussed in the name of desegregating schools or attending a school that received people who were bussed in for the same reason. So I'm curious to hear kind of a mix of personal as well as policy observations. Catherine, you had a pretty unique upbringing, if I'm not mistaken. What did you learn personally about school desegregation policies back when you were presumably carrying a, what, Buffy the Vampire Slayer lunch pail to school?
Your timeline is all screwed up, but yeah.
Wow.
No?
But yeah, so I actually have been thinking about this since apparently all of a sudden we're talking about busing again, which is quite an odd turn of events for a 2019 race. I went to two elementary schools, and this was the busing compromise that happened in Alexandria, Virginia in the 80s. I attended my neighborhood school for K through 3, and then an adjacent, predominantly Black, in fact, historically Black neighborhood school for 4 through 6. And the kids from the Black neighborhood were bussed in the opposite direction. So I was sort of bussed, I guess. And I wish that I had some really good, deep thoughts about how that experience impacted me. It seemed to me at the time to just be sort of dumb. Like, it seemed to be just a lot of fussing around for nothing. But of course, that's appropriate for a small child. In fact, the main takeaway for me was that in fourth grade, we had Black History Year instead of just Black History Month. And I can tell you a lot about Garrett A. Morgan, who invented the traffic light, if you want to know. I think the idea of busing being a live issue right now is interesting, though, because, of course, schools are still extremely segregated. They're segregated because neighborhoods are segregated and because our school districts are based on neighborhoods, which is the root of the problem, in my view.
Nick, I want to invite you to look at the word segregation and segregated in the way that Catherine just used it. Quote yesterday from Kamala Harris, who's, she's doubling her stature in the polls based on this. Mm-hmm. Perhaps. She says, "I support busing. Listen, the schools of America are as segregated, if not more segregated today than when I was in school. We need to put every effort, including busing, into play to desegregate the schools. Federal government has a role and a responsibility to step up." My question is, am I being pedantic in pricking up my ears and thinking that it's a little bit sloppy and misleading to use the word segregated in the same way that we would have used in 1952?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's really worth thinking about why this issue is coming up and why it's targeting a guy who was the vice president and selected, hand-selected by Barack Obama, the first black president. Why is this coming up now? And it's without, you know, questioning, you know, the hideous history of racism and of school segregation, where blacks and whites in many parts of the country were either by law or by custom not allowed to go to school together. You know, this is being used because it's a way to attack Joe Biden, who, you know, by a factor of two is the leader of the Democratic presidential primary so far. And obviously, you know, it's all far out and all of that. But it's a vulnerability for him. And that's why it's coming up, because to talk about public schools now and to talk about the problems with public schools or public education, whether you're talking about race issues or class issues, it's not the same as it was in the 50s, much less, you know, before that or up through the 70s. And it is kind of disturbing to think about the official kind of end of attempts to integrate schools or to desegregate them, and the terms are somewhat analogous and somewhat different, didn't really end until the 70s and later in a couple of places where schools were under consent decrees to desegregate. But this is about politics. You know, Joe Biden, it would be hard to say that Joe Biden has a, you know, an anti-black record in any meaningful way, that you would not be able to basically implicate any of the candidates who are running for president on the Democratic nomination do now, including somebody like Kamala Harris, who as a prosecutor had no problem locking up a lot of people under programs that had racially disparate impacts. And I think more importantly, when we're talking about education policy, you know, the idea of like busing people now is idiotic, especially when you're talking about urban environments where a lot of people live and a lot of school kids go, where the push is to charter schools, where you have local schools that are nearby that people actually choose to go to. And a lot of times those schools are going to be more kind of racially as well as class homogeneous. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. And it's actually the beginning of people actually taking control of their local schools and getting their kids the education they want.
I want to follow up on that, but I'll table that because I'm curious.
And yeah, I mean, just to, I'm sorry to go on as long at this, but it is like to underscore the problems that impact race and racial disparities and the things that come out of that, they are different in 2019 than they were in 1969. You know, and like the quicker that we understand that, and we're making real strides towards that in terms of things like ending the drug war and criminal justice reform and whatnot, and education reform that puts more power in the hands of parents and students, and to try and graft on some model. Busing was never popular. Forced busing was never popular, even among blacks, back when it was, you know, being used in a broad way. This is like a really, you know, serious, you know, I don't care who wins the Democratic nomination, but like, I don't want to see us go back to policies that didn't work in the past and are completely irrelevant to, you know, where we are today as a society.
Peter, you grew up in obviously a racist state of Florida, and I'm only kidding somewhat, but I'm curious about whether you had any personal experience about this, first of all, and then I will follow up with a question having to do with what Nick just said.
So before I lived in Florida, I went to elementary school, most of elementary school, actually in North Carolina in the 1980s. And my parents were, were kind of liberalish, certainly at the time, liberalish, lefty, kind of like college protester types, who I remember when my mother brought me in the 1980s to maybe one of the first Martin Luther King Day ceremonies at a black church, and there was a bomb threat. I want to say the same thing happened the following year. I could be mistaken on that. This was a while ago. And sort of the kind of pretty nasty racial politics were always kind of looming in the background. They didn't affect me personally and directly, but my parents always let me know that they were there. We went to, for example, we were members of a very inexpensive, not country club level, but like a swimming pool club that had only desegregated a few years before. There was quite overt racism, including coming from the administration in my elementary school. Maybe not quite overt is not quite right, but it was, you definitely understood that the people running the school were kind of, they didn't really like having these black kids around. They were new. And, you know, I heard stories. Again, I couldn't verify this, so I want to be clear. I am going on, you know, a 30-year-old recollection of, like, what it was like to be a 5 or a 6-year-old. But I heard stories about not too far from me, the Klan doing cross burnings on the, you know, in the yards of black families when they were moving into white neighborhoods. And that was the kind of the background to living in North Carolina in the mid-1980s. And it was there at school. And in part because white kids that I knew would just talk, would say really vile and racist stuff about the black kids who were at our school. And there was very much a sort of just a racial cliquishness that I both found kind of awful, but also just found kind of baffling because my parents had actually done a very good job of sort of talking me through, like, this is how people think. It's wrong. We don't think that way. I had, I wouldn't say the majority of my friends were black. I had a number of black friends, right? They were just sort of part of the milieu, right? And to sort of be there and having come from, my parents were both Yankees, right? Pennsylvania and Minnesota. And like I was born in Ohio. And so moving there, like it was something that my parents regularly commented on was just sort of, they didn't like the fact that North Carolina always seemed kind of grossly racist under the surface. In a way that the places that they had come from and they grew up in.
So, if I can also just point out real quickly that North Carolina in the 70s and 80s was also considered, you know, about the most progressive of the old Confederacy states. I mean, they were very proud of being racially inclusive. So, Peter, your kind of recollections go, you know, are even more disturbing in spite of that or because of that.
Yeah, I mean, I spent time in Kentucky and when I, you know, in Kentucky, you meet people, first of all, who grew up in Kentucky, but also like you meet people from other parts of the South, Alabama folks, South Carolina folks. And while in some ways it was the racist talk up when it was only, you know, mostly like white dudes around was less than I recall from being a kid in North Carolina. One of the things that has stuck with me much of my life is that when you meet older white men in Kentucky and you're a young white dude and you don't seem to be some, you know, stuck up city kid, they basically assume that you're kind of racist like them and will talk to you as if you are. And so, you know, in a way that like I never experienced racism. I never, right? Like, that's not what I'm trying to say, but I saw it there and I heard it. And it was just sort of like, I have always understood that it is a kind of a barely hidden part of American life, at least in the South.
Catherine, given that Peter's background, sort of living memory of pretty explicitly racist policies and attitudes, and this is always wrapped up in school policies and also just sort of school consumer behavior, by which I mean, I think a lot of school districts, once they were desegregated, immediately kind of like would evaporate and form a new district over here that just happened to be all white people as well. Given that backdrop, which is a real thing, when you see people now responding to this current contemporary debate and seeing the way that Joe Biden is talking about it, kind of backpedaling and portraying his record. I've seen a lot of commentary the last couple of days that even words like what Nick's described as forced busing or forcible busing, even that is kind of a tell for a kind of an old time racist-y type of a feeling. Is there a correction being applied here? Was opposition to busing kind of a stalking horse? Is that a legitimate critique of Biden right now, that opposition to busing was a stalking horse for appealing to racists?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think, you know, again, because this spans sort of from my childhood to my adulthood, I have oddly mixed impressions and memories about it. My feeling is that at this point, to still be perseverating on busing is just actually a proxy for other conversations about race, because that, you know, the era of that as a major controversy genuinely is over. We have other controversies about race and education. But, you know, I think in some ways the fact that we're talking about this right now is just simply a way of suggesting slash implying that Biden is an elderly racist, which is useful to many campaigns, not just Kamala Harris's. And so in that sense, yes, I do think, though, that originally the opposition to busing, the reason it was such a hot button issue was precisely because it was a genuine personal thing with every family involved. Right. Like anyone who's a parent knows you go to great lengths to conveniently arrange your life around your children's schooling and to then be told the school you thought you signed up for will be very different, or your child can't attend that school. They have to get on a bus and go to another school is a major, you know, bread and butter family issue. So there's sort of a realness in the opposition that happened at that level, and also a racism in the opposition and freak out about it that happened at the national level, including people who weren't directly personally impacted by it.
Just a quick question there. You said that it's a little bit of a proxy for other issues about race and also just kind of a way of saying that Joe Biden is an elderly racist. I wonder if it's also, to some extent, just a proxy for talking about how Joe Biden is old.
I mean that a little bit as a joke, but
like very seriously, yeah. Like it's a way of reminding people that Joe Biden has been around for decades and carries the baggage of decades of Democratic policy and cultural ideas with
a
him in a way.
A half century.
That younger Democratic politicians do not.
And in fact, right? I mean, it's one thing that's revealing is how the other candidates jumped on defending Kamala Harris in this conversation where, you know, Cory Booker says she doesn't have shit to prove. And then the other candidates reply in the following hour and a half with much lamer Me Too versions of that same tweet. And I think that's, you know, again, that's something where, you know, we talked in our post-debate podcast, Peter, along with Stephanie Slade, about the elements of intergenerational warfare in the Dem debate. And I think in many ways, you know, I said old and racist together on purpose. It's meant to show and imply both.
Worth saying, pointing out that Cory Booker, for instance, in the clip that we played at the top of the show, he goes on to ding Biden for his support for the mid-90s crime bills. Biden, as we have pointed out on several occasions, has been the opposite of a friend to civil liberties for a really long time. He has fingerprints all over, you know, the precursors of the Patriot Act and the Patriot Act and elsewhere. So it is for the Democratic field, it's part of a larger conversation about Biden's role in some very specific things there. Go ahead, Nick.
It's also the dynamic for the Democratic Party nomination this time around, too. It's clear Hillary Clinton essentially lost because she did not motivate enough black voters who are a reliable part of the Democratic Party constituency. She did not get them out in the numbers that would have put her over the top in places like Wisconsin and Michigan. It might have changed the outcome. So there's a real, I think, you know, some candidates see an opportunity if they can appeal to minorities. And obviously, Harris and Booker have a kind of head start on appealing to African Americans, and they want to try and recapture or rebuild the Obama coalition. I don't think either of them has the kind of charisma that he had. But it's also, there are other people in the Democratic Party who are like, we need to be able to appeal to a wide variety of our constituents. And this is part of that conversation. I think that, again, as somebody who I don't care who, you know, in a certain way, I don't care who becomes president. I want better policies. And like what bothers me about the way this conversation is focusing on certain things that are in the past. We know what we can do if we want to, you know, help race relations in America, if we want to help the economic standing of blacks and other minorities in relation to whites. We have a couple of ideas, and they are directly opposed to what Kamala Harris and what Cory Booker increasingly in the Democratic Party, certainly people like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are talking about, which is we should be pumping more money and more opportunity into charter schools. And when you look at charter schools in large cities, particularly serving highly black and Latino populations, those kids do better under charter schools. And that is what the Democratic Party is running from, is the whole idea of charter schools. And they are, because one of their other constituencies are teachers unions, and teachers unions hate charter schools. And, you know, this this should be one of the conversations we're having, because we don't have to have proxy conversations about race. What's bad with race has to do with, you know, certain types of criminal justice and law enforcement stuff. It has to do with education. It has to do with other kinds of policies that we can talk about specifically, and we have good solutions.
Catherine,
to those problems
right now. Follow up on that in specifically, there is to give you a personal example where I live. There, the district of the school district in New York is attempting to lead the way on what they call desegregation policies. And one of the arguments that they have, they take as kind of a de facto, is that policies of choice, including charter schools, lead to more segregation, not less. What is your answer to that critique, Fancy Pants charter schools proponent?
I am a Fancy Pants charter schools proponent. And I think, you know, there are so many things going on inside that statement. The implication is somehow, I think, that, you know, as always, Democrats of a certain stripe will look to conflate any charter with charters that are run by for-profit management companies. They sort of generally hand wave this idea that charters are out there to make money off of poor kids. There's, of course, a different critique, which is that charters skim, that they pull the best kids out of any neighborhood public school. So there's this weird tension, right? It's like they're somehow providing a bad education to brown and black children for money, then also, though, stealing the good kids to take them away from the public system. I've never been able to reconcile those two arguments. I'm never quite sure what's going on there. But in DC, for instance, which has lots and lots of charters, a very robust charter arrangement, you see that the city largely only approves charters or almost exclusively approves charters in poor neighborhoods, in minority neighborhoods. The whole idea of a charter as providing an out for kids who have bad options means that charters are disproportionately located in places and in circumstances in which Black and brown children will take advantage of them. So, yeah, charters educate people of color disproportionately. The same is true, by the way, of for-profit universities, which is a charge that's often levied against them, sort of with the same weird pairing. I guess the one point that I would make on that front also is, you know, there's this whole hullabaloo about busing. But in fact, charters and school choice often mean that parents will themselves make arrangements to move their children around the city to not go to the most convenient school. I said earlier, lots of parents set themselves up for convenience, and that's true. But also, when given the choice, people will travel for a good education. But there's a huge difference between, quote unquote, forced busing and letting parents choose that for their families and for their kids.
And if I can just add one thing that Harris said that I totally agreed with in the Democratic debate is that she did point out when Biden eventually was talking about, you know, forced busing, or if the local school district had decided on busing, that was okay. And she said that the federal government was, you know, historically has been the guarantor of Black civil rights in the civil rights era, in the post-Civil War era. And that's true. And that's actually something that I think libertarians need to grapple with more openly and more honestly, that as quick as we are to paint the federal government as the worst type of government whatsoever, and there's, you know, good reasons for that, it is true that historically in the 20th century, and certainly after World War II, it was this, you know, it was the federal government that went in and forced the integration of places, you know, in Little Rock and in Mississippi and in Alabama and whatnot. And, you know, we need to understand that, like, the federal government is not all one thing or the other. And in many instances, it was the guarantor of basic inclusion in, you know, in a democratic society.
Peter, before we leave the topic, I'll give you kind of last word on this, just kind of pulling the periscope back and looking at the presidential politics of it. Going into the Democratic debate season, there's kind of a question of who is going to be the person confronting the field and either telling democratic socialism to stop, or telling the kind of the wokeification of the Democratic Party to maybe slow down a bit. Put this discussion in the context of the latter of those two, in terms of elements that might be kind of alarming or worrying to the gettable, you know, former Obama, now Trump voter. How do you assess that the Democratic field did Wednesday and Thursday on questions relating to kind of social, racial type of issues.
Let me maybe answer this just a little bit differently than that. I think what I would say is the first set of debates, democratic socialism as a concept was kind of a loser, while woke, very left liberalism was a winner. And if you look at sort of what who came out ahead of in these debates, it was Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker on the first night, and it was Kamala Harris on the second night. And Joe Biden and actually Bernie Sanders, I think, were the losers. And so on the one hand, you had sort of old mainline centrist Democratic whatever. And on the other hand, you had sort of garrulous, like, let's demand that we are democratic socialists and talk about the concept of democratic socialism, also losing a little bit. But what won was a very progressive, very woke, very left kind of democratic politics that blends policies that really aren't too far from a Bernie Sanders democratic socialist agenda with a younger, more contemporary kind of woke progressive cultural approach.
Thank you for that, Peter Suderman. One thing that wasn't talked about that much during the debates was foreign policy, and I want to shift there. We did certainly talk about both on the blog and elsewhere about the Tulsi Gabbard exchange with especially, what's his face, Ryan from Ohio.
Tim Ryan.
Yeah, it's hard.
The most generic person ever to run for an office.
But man, those eyes are blazing. But anyways, that was about the only nod. There wasn't really a whole lot of discussion about this. There's been a lot of foreign policy, kind of disparate strands of foreign policy news since the last time the four of us convened. I will go over a bit of it. President Trump walked into North Korea to shake hands with Kim Jong-un. He also made, I think, baseless claims that his predecessor had been begging to do the same. There was a big G20 meeting in Japan, at which Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping agreed to a semi-timeout of the trade war. Ivanka Trump was everywhere, mostly in memes, inserting herself to various conversations she didn't belong in. The president made various odd comments in the presence of Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, there's huge protests, very inspiring, in Hong Kong and Khartoum. And finally, and this is where we can knit it all together in a neat little bow, very interesting news over the weekend that billionaire bogeymen, Charles Koch and George Soros, mutual antagonists in the field of presidential politics for a long time, are teaming up to fund a new restraint-based foreign policy think tank in Washington. Nick, you wrote about that this morning. Can you start our little foreign policy bit by telling us a little bit about the facts and the import of the Quincy Institute? And please tell me that it was named after the TV show.
You know, it would be so great if it was named after the Quincy of Medical Examiner, played by Jack Klugman. But of course, it's named after John Quincy Adams, whose one of his most famous lines is that America doesn't go, you know, inch of monsters afar. Type of stuff. So, and, you know, I think it's extremely exciting to see Soros and Koch kind of as, you know, these two lumbering antagonists who are kind of on the fringes of either party that they tended to work through, the Democrats or the Republicans. And they both, in many ways, and certainly Koch, Charles Koch, has kind of disowned partisan politics for the, you know, umpteenth time in his career, but this time it seems to be sticking. But yeah, they're funding a group which also has a lot of money from other people as well that is based on, you know, a rejection of the idea that America needs to be projecting military force and having military presence everywhere all over the globe. And I think it's a sign that you're, you know, Matt, you and I have talked about this. I mentioned it in the piece, the short piece that I put up at Reason. We had been prophesying this type of, you know, ad hoc coalition among people who may not agree on other things coming together on specific topics as a signature characteristic of the 21st century, because our old political alliances, the grand alliances, are breaking down. We know that. I think you're seeing this here. I think it's also, you know, when you look at some of the stuff that's going on, around the globe. It's kind of interesting to see China is being hit, you know, both by American trade wars and, you know, to the extent we're all against trade wars, we're all against tariffs. But the idea that the U.S. might actually push back a little bit on China while they're also dealing with the Hong Kong protests, which is, you know, hundreds of thousands of people saying that we want to maintain the autonomy that was guaranteed us when England gave up Hong Kong back at the turn of the millennium. You know, and you also start to see things like Iranian oil, which is a major supplier.
Not just the national
China.
Autonomy, yeah. though.
No, no, not just individual.
I mean, the individual, like
absolutely.
That is,
no, that's
those protests are heavily about the individual right
absolutely.
To free expression and to protest the
government. And that's, I mean, one of the things that was great about Hong Kong was because it was both a protectorate, but it was a place where individuals could flourish. You know, that the kind of national character, which is wrong to call it a nation, but of Hong Kong is actually very individualistic. I think we're in a moment, including Trump talking to Kim Jong-un, you know, we're in a moment where diplomacy actually seems to be doing better than it was, you know, even a couple of months ago. I think we should all be very excited by a lot of these developments.
Catherine, how surprised were you that your dear friend Bill Kristol immediately invoked the 1930s in response to this new foreign policy think tank?
0% surprised. No surprise. The headlines on the Koch Soros thing often were some variant of surprisingly or astonishingly these two are working together. And I think it's like it's officially like a cliche now, or like it's a trope that people just keep being surprised that the Kochs are libertarians. They just keep being like, Charles Koch of all people likes the things he has liked for 40 years. I am shocked. And it's just like, when will we be finished? It's like no one writes like, astonishingly, Bill Kristol still likes war. Like that's nobody ever writes that sentence. And yet Charles Koch, we can get to the astonishingly. I wanted to read us the full quote, the Quincy Adams quote, because I think it's kind of great. It's, you know, on this week in 1821, he declared that the United States does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. She is a well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. She is the champion and vindicator only of her own. That's good stuff, y'all. Well-wisher to the freedom and independence of all. I am. We are. We should be. And I think the Hong Kong protests are a great example. Like, I well-wish the hell out of that. And I think, like, diplomacy falls more in the well-wishing than in the vindication and championing of. So I agree with Nick there, but you know, John Quincy Adams never gets enough credit for the goodness there.
It's pretty interesting that well wishing is almost never appended by those who quote that. That's a favorite quote of anti-interventionists. And I think there's always been a split among anti-interventionists, including libertarians, but also on the left. When they hear well-wishing for freedom fighters abroad, they hear the stalking horse of American interventionists. And so it's really difficult for people to kind of wrap their mouths around both sentiments at once when I think it should be pretty natural. Peter Suderman, is this not your dream come true? Is this not like the application of the great Suderman, or the response to the great Suderman lament about the lack of infrastructure in D.C. for a restraint-based
finance? I don't know if it's my entire dream come true, but it's like
the,
it's like
the
one
rest
of
Peter's
my
dream has
dreams.
To do with like zombie killing, though. So let's not have that part come true.
There's
Sebelius.
Too little Batman. The Institute for Batman Studies is my actual dream come true. Yeah, this is how ideological politics should be. Issue-based coalitions of like-minded people on specific issues rather than partisan kind of, you know, teamwork where it's just about supporting your team regardless of what they do. And,
this is the opposite of tribalism.
Yes, it's exactly the opposite of it, and it's good, and it's also really necessary. I mean, there just is so little policy infrastructure in Washington, D.C. for anti-interventionism, and you see that play out in our national debates. And if you ever, you know, sort of like, every once in a while, I get in a conversation with a normal person, and I'm like, oh, I work for a magazine that is published by a nonprofit organization that also has a think tank. I've worked at other think tanks. I know a lot of people that work at think tanks, and people are like, what is a think tank? What does it do? And you can, we all know what it does. They put out white papers. They put, you know, have panels. They pay smart people to think of things and sit in an office and sometimes give interviews to our staffers who then, and then we write up their ideas. It's a lot of conversation and sort of idea churning. And like, and sometimes it just sort of seems like completely like, what are we doing? What's the impact? Why does this matter? And then you look at foreign policy where virtually every dollar and every expert is interventionist in character somehow or another, and you look at how Washington conducts foreign policy and where the center of gravity is in both parties, and you see, oh, there's no real debate here because there's no real debate here. And that's what this organization seems to be designed to at least start to address.
I would just like to insert into Peter's description of think tanks two disclaimers. One, we didn't mention it, but Charles Koch and David Koch have obviously contributed to the Reason Foundation over the years. David Koch, until very recently, was a member of the board. And also, the Reason's think tank is a little bit different than that. It's not very, it does a lot of white papers and great research, especially on transportation and other stuff, but it works pretty closely in a pragmatic way with motivated government officials to do stuff like reform pensions and fix kind of infrastructure and highway stuff. It's pretty unusually practical based in like, hey, let's fix this policy. Who's with us? We can figure that out. Catherine, do you want to amplify that?
Yes, in any way? That's a good addition, and it's just sort of worth even more adding to that there are a bunch of different think tank models. It's not just pay a guy to sit in a suit in an office and write white papers. But it sometimes seems like there's an awful lot of that, and it can be a little bit difficult to explain to people who like have normal and real jobs what a think tank is and what they do.
And pursuant to Peter's longstanding critique here, depending on how close those said tanks are with political parties, it's also a source of talent for administrations. So that tends to be a little bit less.
I absolutely thought you were going to say a source of post hoc rationalization for things that those parties do.
Exactly true as well.
Catherine.
These things overlap to a
That is actually degree. What talent is in politics.
That's terrible.
I, you know, for a hot second there, that Hong Kong conversation was making me feel optimistic about the possibility that sometimes the people united together can actually stop government from doing bad things. And then you said that, and now I'm sad again.
Kind of amplify the role of think tanks or of public intellectuals or private intellectuals, policy analysts and whatnot. Milton Friedman used to talk about how, you know, one of the basic ideas of both think tanks and thinkers more generally is, and I'm quoting, to develop alternatives to existing policies to keep them alive and available until the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. And my hope for the Quincy Institute is that it helps provide an intellectual kind of superstructure for building a consensus that is, you know, contrary to the one that we've been living under for the past 70 years and the one that Bill Kristol laments the end of. And it's important to understand the end is coming after decades of failure. The 21st century has been a complete and utter rout and disaster for a kind of, you know, for lack of a better word, hawkish or neocon foreign policy. We need a different strategy. We need a different vision. And to the extent that this group and other groups like it, you know, are building towards that and helping to shift the way we think about stuff. We had a consensus during the Cold War, but Democrats and Republicans were on the same side of the Cold War for the most part. The Cold War is over. We need something new. And hopefully, you know, a more libertarian, Will Ruger, who works at the Charles Koch Institute, talked about in our pages as a kind of libertarian realism. You know, this is not isolationism by any stretch, but it's having a military, it's having a defense capability, it's being involved in world affairs, but it's also being realistic and restrained. This is exactly the type of operation that will hopefully help to change ideas. There's still the military-industrial complex to go on, and a lot of this stuff moves on money. It's not about ideas, but ideas really matter, and they start to build up steam over time.
Just a short note on this, which is that if you think back just a week or two ago when we talked about this, President Trump was reportedly something like 10 minutes from bombing Iran. And who did he talk to who turned out to be the relevant person who said, maybe you shouldn't do that? Tucker Carlson. That's how shallow the movement for, like, the intellectual apparatus for non-interventionism is in Washington. All of his advisors were saying, you should do this. All of his foreign policy team was saying, we should obviously go and bomb Iran and perhaps kill 150 people because they destroyed a drone. And the goal here, it seems to me, is to change that and to have an intellectual infrastructure that means that the next president doesn't have to get that advice from Tucker Carlson.
To defend Bill Kristol just for a half a second, one of his objections was that, hey, look, you know, we've had seven decades of global trade and tariff reduction that's been prosperous and helpful for the world. That is absolutely true. I think the question is, does the price of that mean America is the global cop at all times? And I think that the answer to that is unequivocally no, it doesn't and shouldn't. And I would also presume, without knowing, and I haven't looked at under the hood of this thing at all, that if we're talking about something in which Charles Koch and George Soros have any kind of influence over, the chances of it being anti-trade seem kind of low.
Zero, to be honest. Zero at the top end. Yeah.
I wanted to make sure we had at least a little bit of time for a disturbing story over the weekend. Probably seen this if you paid attention to social media. Andy Ngo, journalist for Quillette, who covers a lot of Antifa protests, had the snot kicked out of him at a protest in Portland, which apparently is the city of nonstop idiotic skirmishes between Antifa and the Proud Boys. Robbie Suave wrote about it over the weekend. In terms of the reaction of people to it, there's at least a fair number of blue check mark humans saying, "Well, Andy Ngo is not a journalist. He's a handmaiden to white supremacist. Quillette is right wing. What do you expect?" That type of thing. Pretty awful stuff in general. And I would also kind of make a broader background to it. There's a piece over the weekend by a restaurateur in Washington, D.C., where she sort of defended this Stephanie Wilkinson, who I think owns the restaurant that Sarah Huckabee Sanders was hounded out of. And she wrote a piece defending the notion that restaurants can tell you to go to hell based on your politics. Just a couple of minor points I want to tease out of that. But first, on a pure little social media thing, Suderman, is this an example of how Twitter actually doesn't help and is misleading? I wonder if really there is a lot of support for Andy Ngo to get the crap beat out of him, or did everyone just rush to Twitter and look for the seven people who said stupid things?
I don't think Twitter helps the discourse about most things, and this is a thing, but especially in terms of these events, where. So I was mostly off of Twitter this weekend, so I can't say that I followed every detail of it. I saw a bunch of it going through our Slack, and I had some discussions about it with other people. But in what Twitter isn't designed to evoke rational and empathetic and useful responses in a situation like this. And I think it amplifies the worst voices, and it gives cover for other people who kind of may have had some, sympathies or whatever with those awful voices. And it just creates a kind of a crowding and swarming effect where the worst of the worst becomes the loudest. And really just does bad things to our discourse. I just don't think it's a very good place for talking about politics. It's a pretty good place for, like, goofing off and joking around, about movies or video games or cocktails or even for making fun of the debates. It's a pretty good place for getting quick live updates on extremely chaotic breaking news situations, even though you, of course, have to take a lot of what gets said with a grain of salt and understand that it will be either confused, misleading, or wrong, sometimes intentionally, but it's really a bad place for discourse about political violence. And I think this weekend probably proves that.
I'm old enough to remember when Twitter was one of the sites of fomenting revolution against countries like Iran and other parts of the Arab Spring, and it was a place where you could show solidarity and support. I agree. I mean, Twitter as a platform is, you know, kind of a dumpster fire, but it has the potential to be great on all of this stuff. And I think I don't blame the medium for the idiots who are on it. And it's deeply disturbing to me as a professional journalist, when you see journalists, and there are some who are out there, who mock or diminish the idea of a guy being beaten up for covering an event. And he's, you know, by in no account has Andy Ngo ever like gotten in the face of people. He's never been menacing or whatever. He gets beaten up by people who are wearing ski masks or balaclava helmets or scarves on their face. There's other footage coming out of Portland where like just regular people are being hit in the head with crowbars and things like that. It's seriously fucked up. And this is, you know, people talk all the time about Trump, destroying norms. To the extent that he does, he's joined in equal force by people all over the political spectrum who are just like, fuck it. I'm just, you know, I just want to see, the mascots that I dislike taken down. It's very disturbing. But I don't think it's a social media phenomenon. I also do think there's something wrong with our political discourse when restaurateurs, you know, of course, they have absolute right to do whatever they want and stuff. But when you hear about people being kicked out or, Eric or Donald Trump, I think Eric Trump was supposedly spit on at a bar. Like, you know, this is just there's something really rancid here that needs to be called out and kind of reset in terms of civil discourse.
Catherine, I'll let you put a button on this. Why can't we all get along?
We definitely can't and won't. I actually thought the thing that was interesting in the Andy Ngo story was how much of it revolved around the question of who is and who isn't a journalist. Because I think this is a theme that we've come back to over and over on this podcast and in Reason. Like, journalists, I don't think, should have special rights. Other people should have the rights we think journalists have. Those are basically free speech and free association and privacy rights. And the fact that there was somehow this implication that if you could prove that Andy was not a real journalist because he was associated with Quillett or because his politics were wrong or because he was, you know, in some subtle way not part of what Antifa considers a journalist, and then subsequently what Twitter considers a journalist, then it's okay. If he got beat up, then it's okay if he was treated badly. And that's not true. Of course, that's not true. Anyone who wants to go with a camera or a notepad and write down what they see anywhere in the public sphere should be allowed to do that. I thought that Parker Malloy, who is not any mm-hmm. particular friend of Reason, did a solid on Twitter by noting that they had gotten the story wrong. That's something you don't see a ton, but there were some people who initially said, this guy is a whiner who's not really a journalist, and then said, oh no, wait, sorry, never mind. Actually, this is horrific and shouldn't happen. So kudos to those people. The other piece of it, though, is, and I don't know if y'all followed this at all, this sort of second order rumor that maybe the milkshakes had cement in them. Which I think is probably not true, right? Like, if I were just going on just the basic skepticism template, which is good to apply to this sort of story, there was like an email written after an initial accusation that maybe there was cement and no one who had any evidence, as far as I know. I think, you know, that does also changes the equation. You know, something that can look sort of a little bit silly and, you know, unpleasant but harmless can turn out to actually have been quite a violent act. And again, that's why we should all just take it down a notch in public and let each other move freely and peaceably.
Nick mentioned earlier the kind of a comparison with Donald Trump, you know, who is often accused of destroying norms, I think correctly. One of the kind of things that we have seen journalists complain about in the Trump era is the pretty vile, actually pretty nasty harassment that the journalist pens get at the Trump rallies, with people coming up and yelling and really being quite ugly to them. And, you know, they feel unsafe. And I think that that's, even though there haven't been violent incidents, I think that's even reasonably fair given the context. But it's worth kind of comparing, like, journalists at Trump rallies who are getting yelled at are feeling unsafe. But, you know, there are actual leftist protesters who are beating up journalists, who are beating up people who are trying to write about and cover protests in real time. And so, you know, it's not just a phenomenon that is happening on the right. It is happening on the right and the left. And it's pretty disheartening and ugly to watch.
I actually do want to flag, by the way, I disagree with Nick a bit about the restaurant evictions. I think that it is not only well within the rights of the restaurateurs to throw people out with whom they disagree, but also, you know, not always a bad practice. You know, I think, you know, we disagree about this on social media platforms as well. But I think a good way for society to self-police civility is to create a nested series of terms of service. Now, I do think it should be clear who's allowed in and who's not before they take your order, right? And this is
no shoes, no shirt, no service, no sandals.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, to be honest, though, I
just as long as it's out on the front.
I genuinely think that, you know, you're kind of
that includes Bernie Sanders.
All the Sanderses. No,
and Colonel Sanders.
Colonel Sanders, yeah. Bernie Sanders, Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I actually do just want to put in a bid for private business owners should be able to, and also should, throw out people that they don't feel right doing business with for whatever reason. It's not up to us to police those reasons.
So do you like? I agree that they have you know, the right to do it, but then it's a question of, is it a wise policy? You know,
Gab
on any
knitting.
Given level. But so with Ravelry, the knitting website, social media knitting site, are you good
right.
with them saying, hey, you can be on here, but you can't say anything positive about Donald Trump? And it's not clear if they're like, it's okay if you say something negative. And again,
so it was,
they have the right to do it. Let's, you know, I'll stipulate that, but it seems stupid and kind of dumb to me. And, I guess, you know, it creates
O-M-G.
A situation where, yeah, you know, in the event that I take up knitting, I'll probably go to, you know, a less politicized knitting site, but.
Can I say that I would pay literally $1,000 for you to knit me a scarf? Like, if I could wear around a scarf that was like, Nick Gillespie has taken up knitting and he made this for me, I would be delighted.
Somewhere in a landfill in New Jersey, a Superfund site,
yuck.
Because they all are. There is a Afghan that I crocheted with my mother back sometime in the 70s. So I'll try and find that
incredible.
For you.
Yeah. So, I mean, to answer your substantive question, I think, again, ideally, not everything is political. Ideally, most restaurants would have no policy along these lines. Ideally, most websites would have no policies along these lines. But we actually published a piece by Katrina Gulliver, who is a sometime Reason contributor and also a Ravelry user, who noted that it really is more of a social media site than just a knitting site. And there are boards for all kinds of things, and people talk about all kinds of things on there. And, you know, if they want a more homogeneous community, then so be it. And I think, you know, a nested series of bans and counter boycotts is actually how we already live our lives. But it would be better to be more explicit about all of it if this is what we're going to do.
I think that leads to a culture of terms of service scolds everywhere, just as we've seen.
We already live in that culture.
We can turn it back.
That's a bad
you know,
culture.
Matt is...
That leads to
is Rosie Greer still alive,
everything.
Matt? Can we get him to front a needlepoint and or knitting site?
It's all right to cry.
It would be
I'm with Catherine on this.
This is generational.
If all human relations were governed by more contracts, that would be better.
I'm with Catherine on this, and I think the key thing that she brought up is that these people are managing communities, and there's a commercial element as well. But in the same way that a bar owner has a right and arguably
to,
even
to
a
keep
duty,
blacks out if his clientele is racist. No, but that's what it comes down
to keep,
right?
To keep,
I mean, that's the extreme version of this.
But to throw out somebody who is making the community not what they want, right? And like if there's somebody who's coming
eating
there's
a
somebody
meal.
Who comes in and is causing trouble, And is, you know, is sort of not upholding the values, right? It's sort of like that's, and I think that we forget that business owners are in many cases, especially online, running and managing communities. And communities have a right to self-police and to self-organize. This free association is literally built into our constitution.
We had months or weeks or at least days of strenuous public debate over whether a 17-year-old kid from high school was a racist because he was wearing a MAGA hat. How do you think this ends? This ends with MAGA hats not being served. That is a bad place. I don't care what you're talking about. I don't care how self-communities and contracts and nested eagles.
I don't think you're right about though. I think you're empirically wrong. I think the vast majority of places that provide goods and services recognize that it's not in their interest to not serve MAGA hats. And the few that do make that choice should be allowed to.
Again, not a question if they should be allowed to. It's just, it's a better world. I would argue, normatively, it is a better world when more people depoliticize things to a point where you can talk with people you disagree with. You can eat at the lunch counter next to them, even if they're wearing a MAGA shirt or a, you know, Joe Biden anti-busing outfit or something like that.
I think if we condemn people that do this type of policing on a voluntary level, then we invite this type of policing at a mandatory level.
Show it. We'll find out, I guess. Right?
I mean, that's a lot of what Josh Hawley's Section 230 revision bill is about.
Oh, you just brought in the Josh Hawley's. Things are getting real now.
This is like a French goodbye when you start to putting the heavy stuff at the end. Let's go to, speaking of the end of this, it's
French goodbye. Wow.
It's you stand at the door as you're leaving the party, and you bring up a new conversation that lasts for 45 minutes. Nick.
By the way, if I can just say, there's nothing worse than like saying hello or goodbye at gatherings dominated by French people. Because it takes forever. The only thing worse are people from the former French colonies.
It's almost like you might want to choose to have like a community or a social gathering where you would exclude people who do certain types of behaviors, because that might be better.
Well, so you're saying you just rule out any French colonies?
You had terms of service to get into my house.
The Swiss kiss three times, not twice. So it's just like you never get out of there. Let's go to our end of podcast. What the hell have you been consuming? Peter, you start.
I've been playing God of War, a video game on the PlayStation 4 that came out last year that was incredibly well reviewed and that I didn't get to play when it first came out. And I'm just a little bit into it, but it's really kind of fascinating. So this is like a 15-year-old franchise that is just the most ridiculous sort of like bloody, over the top, like you're a kind of an ancient Norse god type and you just like pull the horns out of like, 13-story tall monsters' heads. And it's so crazy and over the top. And they've totally reinvented this series as like a kind of quiet and, you know, sort of and frankly subtle story about an old man and his son, right? So it starts off with the god who you play, Kratos, and his son. His wife is dead. You know, their wife and mother is dead, and it's all about, you know, taking her ashes to the mountain so that they can dispose of them in the way that she had wanted. And it's this really sort of like kind of fascinating story about like teaching a son to grow up, like except in the middle of a video game about a god with an axe who sometimes runs into the world serpent and like has to kill mountain-sized trolls.
Nick, help me.
Can you hear yourself sometimes, Peter? Like, do you listen to your own?
I was
going to
say it
like,
sounds
what?
Like a video game based on the poetry of Thomas Tranströmer, the Swedish poet who won a Nobel Prize a few years ago. It is all about human beings encased in ice and incapable of fully.
I mean, it's a really,
like
it's
another,
a weirdly
to, so.
Beautiful
That's
game,
actually kind of
visually,
touching.
But also just in sort of like the way it kind of gets it. Oh, his son is, you know, a little bit cleverer than he is, but also more sensitive. And here's this old man who's like has trouble expressing his feelings, and of course has like the deepest voice.
Does he wear the Viking helmet backwards? you know, and the father is kind of upset about that.
I have like, no, he wears a helmet of front? Any kind. He's bald and bearded, you know.
And pull up your pants.
Well,
go, Nick, please.
So I watched John and Yoko, Above Us Only Sky, which Netflix, which is a documentary about the making of John Lennon and Yoko Ono and the Plastic Ono Band's Imagine record in 1971. It is phenomenal. I watched and talked about the Bob Dylan documentary about the Rolling Thunder Review a while ago. I also recently watched Scorsese's couple of years old George Harrison documentary, Living in the Material World. But this is great for all sorts of reasons, and you don't have to like the Beatles at all to get into it. But for me, and Matt, I know we've talked about this in other contexts, the great thing for me about it is that Yoko Ono is so underappreciated as a kind of change agent in American culture. And in the same way that Harrison getting involved with Ravi Shankar and kind of sitar music kind of opened up and blew apart a kind of Western understanding of what, you know, what pop music might be or what kind of references we might use. Yoko Ono, who's, you know, of Japanese birth, but then also was raised partly in America, went to school in America, and was involved in the Fluxus movement in the 60s, late 50s and early 60s in New York City, just brings such an incredible array of strangeness and oddity and beauty and art and love, like, I mean, just a weird rhetoric that transformed John Lennon. And I think it took him from being, you know, a great rock star to being something better than that. And a lot of the stuff that he did was terrible afterwards and all of that. But it's just, it's an incredible moment when something really weird and interesting and just off the charts, kind of like Philip K. Dick weirdness, took place in the early 70s among a bunch of the Beatles, but especially John and Yoko. It's a really powerful documentary, and it reminds you that individual people coming from different places can kind of arbitrage what they know and just have like an enormous cultural impact that makes all of us, it makes it easier for all of us to be personal or individuals. And it's just a wonderful story.
I would just add that, because you knew I was going to, for whatever reason, critical consensus has circled around the Plastic Ono Band mm-hmm. original release as being the great critical wonder of Lennon's solo career, and has looked down on the record Imagine. Yeah. And that's an incorrect way of looking at it. There's a lot of wonderful bile directed at Paul McCartney on Imagine. It's not all saccharin and sugar. It's a pretty goddamn interesting record. Catherine, wake
Hi.
Up.
Good morning.
What have you been consuming out there in East Egg?
I am indeed on Long Island. I've only been here for one day, so I don't yet have any East Egg specific consumption recommendations. But I am reading Story, Substance, Structure, Style, and the Principles of Screenwriting by Robert McKee. I am reading it at the recommendation of my recent colleague, Todd Cranin, after having also read the one about killing the cat. No, saving the cat. Sorry. Freudian.
Saving the cat.
Sometimes is just, you have to kill the cat to save the cat.
Saving the cat is basically just a sort of a Reader's Digest version.
To be clear with reasons, podcast listeners, have no intention to write a screenplay, will never write a screenplay. Dear God, it is my nightmare. But I like to sometimes think a little bit about how to tell good stories. And since my natural story structure is just to raise other people's bad arguments and then explain why they're wrong, I thought maybe I would try this slightly more human approach instead.
Speaking of telling stories, mine is a magazine story, which actually came out in March or April in The New Yorker, but it came to my attention over the weekend, blew my socks clean off. And I still haven't even finished it because it's The New Yorker. It's probably 5 trillion words. But the kind of best top of a story that I've read in a while, I will read you just the opening paragraph to give you a sense of it. And I will mispronounce so many words in it that it's important not to laugh.
Sorry.
Catherine. Okay. The story is called. Oh shit! I just got the New Yorker little pop-up window. Don't do it. It's by Douglas.
That's a weird title.
Douglas Preston, and it's called. I can't see the title anymore. Okay, here we go. If On a certain evening about 66 million years ago, you had stood somewhere in North America and looked up at the sky. You would have soon made out what appeared to be a star. If you watched for an hour or two, the star would have seemed to grow in brightness, although it barely moved. That's because it was not a star, but an asteroid, and it was headed directly for Earth at about 45,000 miles an hour. 60 hours later, the asteroid hit. The air in front was compressed and violently heated, and it blasted a hole through the atmosphere, generating a supersonic shockwave. The asteroid struck a shallow sea where the Yucatan Peninsula is today. In that moment, the Cretaceous period ended, and the Paleogene period began. And it just goes from there with all kinds of gory asteroid porn. And it's a story about paleontology and the way that we think about dinosaur bones and all kinds of stuff. Just great, fun, wonderful writing that doesn't start with talking about how bad Josh Hawley is on everything, although that's always apropos.
That story is fantastic. And one of the interesting things about it is that the site that is at the center of that story has remained in privately owned for various reasons. The other thing that I just want to point out is that that story generated one of the dumber like takes of the year in Slate. I'll just read you the title. It's time for the heroic male paleontologist trope.
I kind of like that. Matt, I'm amazed. Like what? But you don't know how the story ends.
Replaced by the sexy badass female paleontologist,
right, or something. Yeah, Jane Goodall meets a girl with dragon tattoo. Come on.
This reminds me that everyone should go see while it still exists. Of one of the weirdest museums in the world. It's in Silver Lake, California, near sort of Hollywood and Dodger Stadium. Yeah. It's called the Holy Land Museum, and it is the museum that is run by the family of a guy whose name I forget, but he was the paleontologist, the swashbuckling paleontologist on whom the character Indiana Jones was based. And it's clear that the family has a whole lot of guilt about the artifacts, the religious artifacts that he stole from various, indigenous communities. And so it is a museum dedicated to tri-faith tolerance and wonderment.
Is it Roy Chapman Andrews, Matt?
Could be. That sounds about it. It's a Leonard Pimpf Barnell or whatever his name is. And it's got these great recreations of the Middle East. It's a wonderful, totally bizarre place. And you should go see it. And it is the end of the heroic male paleontologist. So he becomes a woke interfaith evangelist. And that's all the sighing that we have time for here on the Reason Podcast. Thank you for
come back with us and tell us how that story ends, Matt. Because I bet it ends. I bet it ends in a denunciation of Donald Trump.
I mean, it's just implied. But no, it's great. And Peter's right. There's a lot of interesting noodling about the role of markets, of all things, in the world of paleontology and the controversy surrounded by it. So there are some libertarian angles in it, I swear, in addition to great death porn. Okay, thank you for listening to our death porn, and see you sometime next week. Please rate and review us wherever you see us, and good night.